You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by Brand Driven Digital, helping you build better brands online through strategic consulting, digital coaching, and training and events. Learn more at branddrivendigital.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Steve McKee. Steve is president of McKee Wallwork & Company, Advertising Age's 2015 Southwest Small Agency of the Year. He's the author of When Growth Stalls, How It Happens, Why You're Stuck, and What to Do About It, an award-winning business book now published in four languages, and Power Branding, Leveraging the Success of the World's Best Brands. MWC specializes in revitalizing stalled, stuck, and stale brands across the U.S. A marketing strategist for nearly 30 years, Steve has held executive positions at notable international agencies, including NW Air, Della Femina, and a division of McCann Erickson Worldwide. He's also the co-founder of a successful Bay Area tech startup, a company that is redefining an entire industry as a result of insightful research into its rationally irrational consumers. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Steve was a popular BusinessWeek.com columnist for more than a decade and has been published or quoted in the New York Times, USA Today, Forbes.com, Investors Business Daily, and the Los Angeles Times, among others. A popular speaker at corporate and association events, he has appeared on CNBC, ESPN2, CNN-FN, Bloomberg, and network television affiliates across America, and now the On Brand podcast. Steve, welcome to On Brand.
Great to be here, Nick. Thanks.
Now, I tripped over that wonderful phrase in your bio that talks about rationally irrational consumers. And yeah. I kind of love that description. I feel like that's a good way, you know, as we sit here at the height of holiday shopping craziness, all of the fervor around us, I feel like a lot of us are rationally irrational.
Yes, it's true. It's a little bit of a sleight of hand. It's actually one of my more popular keynotes is that topic. And I like to say rationally irrational because it's really about how we make rational and non-rational decisions. Irrational is sort of a pejorative term, you know, like you're being irrational.
Mm-hmm.
But the point of it, the point of saying that is, you know, very few, if any, decisions are made rationally. I call it the fallacy of rationality, that somehow we believe that people take in all the available information and make a rational decision about something. This is not how we're wired. So we're all rationally irrational to one extent or another.
Well, and I think that's especially important when, you know, we're working in the kind of art and science of brand building. And I think we want to believe that everything happens in this prescriptive, easy to track and assemble great marketing around manner. But that it is a state of organized chaos.
Yeah. And you know, what's funny about it is in our consumer lives, you know, we can sort of wink at ourselves and we know that we make decisions for all kinds of reasons. But when we get in the conference room around the conference table wearing our ties and get all MBA, you know, we think that, well, you know, here's the unique selling proposition and here's the 4 points of – and it's just silly. It's not how people make their buying decisions.
So with this being a popular keynote, I have to imagine that – you know, all of this adds up, but then the question has to be, you know, when you introduce this topic, I get it. So what do you do?
Yeah. well, that's the value of our profession, right? I have there's an acronym that we use. It's called CERTS, like the breath mint. And CERTS stands for context, expectations, risks, trade-offs, and shortcuts. And what I tell my audiences and my clients is, in order to understand our rationally irrational consumers, we have to understand all those things: the context in which they're making the decision, the expectations that are partly a result of that context, the risks that are a ramification of their expectations and the context, the trade-offs that they're going to be making in order to mitigate those risks, and the shortcuts that they're going to use in making the decision. And that gets pretty, it's like a five-dimensional Rubik's Cube. You never get there in terms of a full understanding, but you don't have to get there. You just have to get pretty close.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. A five-dimensional, you've made things more simple, believe it or not, with a five-dimensional Rubik's Cube. That that is another attention-getting statement. So, you know, in looking at that, the other thing that I like that's kind of peppered throughout your work, whether it's, you know, your books or talking, you know, in your bio on how MWC revitalizes stalled, stuck, and stale brands. How do you define stalled, stuck, and or stale as it pertains to businesses and brands?
Great question. Stalled is the easiest, and I mean, it really is in the eye of the beholder. It's in the eye of the brand. But generally speaking, we define a stalled brand as a stalled that's just flat or going backwards in terms of its revenue. That's sort of the easiest definition. And our research shows that in a normal year, about 13 or 14% of all brands are going backwards, believe it or not. In the average decade, half of all companies go backwards. And of course, the last decade has been anything but average, so the numbers have been higher. Stalled and stale are a little bit different. We work with not just struggling brands, but brands that have a marketing challenge or opportunity that is a head scratcher, that they just can't figure out because it's such a one-off. So one example is a restaurant chain that just kills it in their home markets, just kills it. But when they're trying to expand into new markets, they've fallen flat. And they didn't really know what to do because they were used to having so much success. And so the challenge there, they were stuck, if you will. The challenge there was find a way to bottle and export the brand, which we did. In the case of a staled company, we worked with a Fortune 100 corporation that went through a radical period of transformation over 5 years, strategic transformation, and forgot to tell anybody about it. So woke up one day, and I'm oversimplifying, of course, and realized that their brand still meant what it used to mean in people's minds, not what it should mean. And so they brought us on board to help figure out how to catch up the brand identity with the reality on the ground. And so those are the assignments that we love because they're really, really hard.
Well, I always hesitate to say that because it makes us sound like we're kind of sitting here licking our chops. But I love problems like that. I mean, the complexity of it. But I think that is that's the fun creature that we brand builders are. So in looking at this, I mean, so what is the prescriptive approach in these scenarios when you find yourself stalled, stale, or stuck?
Yeah, now that's the big question. So just a little bit of context. My first book, When Growth Stalls, is based on almost a decade of research, quantitative studies that identified the internal dynamics that tend to get and keep companies down. And what was so breakthrough at the time, and the reason I wrote the book, was we're all so focused on external market externalities, whether it's the competition or the economy or changing technologies or what have you, which are all legitimate. But we tend to overlook the internal psychological dynamics that tend to get companies down. And what we find is when a company is struggling, those internal dynamics rear their ugly heads. And there are four. And most companies that are struggling will identify with most or all of these. The first and most difficult is a lack of alignment among senior management. There's disagreement around the table, which I could talk an hour on. It's very insidious. But briefly, the second is a loss of focus or a lack of focus in the organization. The third is a loss of nerve. Companies that are struggling get scared. And the fourth is inconsistency, which is really a manifestation of the other three because struggling companies tend to cast about for silver bullet solutions and they don't find them. And so the first thing that we do, which makes us unique, we're the only firm of our kind anywhere, as far as I know, because we have this research, is we address the internal dynamics first and concurrent with addressing the strategic elements. And the first and most important task is to generate internal alignment, ideally all the way up and down the corporation, but at a minimum among the senior management team. That's where the starting place has to be.
Well, I love that message. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, you know, you can do so much, but unless you are, you know, you do have that buy-in from the top. And really, I think back on some of those pitfalls, those challenges, and I feel like when you know, you can see those in different dimensions of leadership, the lack of focus, nerve, leading to the aforementioned inconsistencies too. So, I mean, I always think of it, you know, as kind of concentric circles that, you know, you have to kind of start on the inside circle before you can kind of level up and out to those other circles too.
Yeah, and what we find is that in all but the most autocratic brands, and there are some of those, you know, Apple under Steve Jobs, Howard Schultz, a little more benevolent, but in Starbucks' case, in all but the most autocratic brands, it doesn't matter how much somebody on the management team believes in the plan. What matters is how much everybody on the management team believes in the plan. And that's not management by committee. That's not what I'm talking about. The analogy I like to use is, you know, the prime minister or the president of a country is the commander in chief. And sometimes they do need to make that executive decision and just say, we're going to, you know, go to war. Just to use the analogy. But if the armed services and the generals are not all aligned with the objectives of the war plan and the exit strategy of the war plan, you're going to have carnage. And the same thing is true in a corporate environment. Sometimes the CEO needs to make that executive decision, you know, sometimes fairly often, and that's fine. But if the staff, if the senior management team is not aligned around that decision, it's not gonna happen. It's just not gonna happen. And we see it over and over and over again. It's the most insidious problem we find. And it just doesn't matter how good the strategy is if it's not gonna get executed. My favorite saying of late is strategy without execution is only theory. And we see that over and over.
Well, I'm a huge proponent of strategy, but I agree with you because I think that sometimes it gets misused, abused, and I think, like, again, your scenario of all of us around the table with our ties on in, you know, MBA mode, and, you know, we kind of focus on what looks like a good strategy as opposed to something that's actually, you know, a functional map that's going to get us from point A to point B.
Yeah. And in the meantime, if some of us around the table are rolling our eyes or being passive aggressive or having hallway conversations after the meeting, that's the real issue right there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to, I mean, again, it's another layer of kind of that alignment that you're talking about, the real strategy. It's not the document, the thing we put in the binders that we order and make a cover for and put tabs in and put up on the shelf by the crisis plan.
Yeah. And the beautiful thing is when we do begin, and we do, again, we begin our engagements by, we have a unique planning model that we use to generate a foundation of alignment. And once you do that, there's a natural set of steps that can lead the company to focus. And once a company gets focused, everybody gets excited if they're aligned. And when you're excited, you overcome sort of naturally the loss of nerve. And if you've done your work correctly, consistency doesn't, it's always a challenge because, you know, we all get bored. But if you've got the right plan and alignment around it and excitement around it, at least it has a chance to be executed over time.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of an elegant solution. You know, when you line up the dominoes in the proper order at the proper distance, and you knock the first one over, it's not quite as automatic as that, but it is sort of the same level of elegance of a solution. Very rewarding.
The simple fact, too, that, you know, especially when you talk about the rest of the team, the rest of the organization, I mean, I say it and I laugh at how elementary it sounds, but when they know what the direction is, what the strategy is, what we're moving towards, they're going to follow it better. They're going to be in better alignment. You're going to see better results.
Yeah, when they've co-created it, legitimately co-created it, not been in the room, they tend to be in alignment. Again, unless you've got an iconic CEO who is aligning people by, you know, snapping them to it, which does work. If you are Steve Jobs or you are Howard Schultz or you are Herb Kelleher, you know, if you are that kind of a CEO, that works. If you're not, don't fool yourself.
Yeah, I think that sometimes that's like the double-edged sword of these kind of, you know, of lionizing these business icons, is that it works if you're them, but statistically speaking, very few of us are them.
Yeah, and we can't judge for ourselves whether we're them.
Right.
So ask your wife; she'll tell you.
Right. Yeah. That's a good tip. You know, at what point are you just being, you know, like you said, a kind of a jerky autocrat there?
Right. Right.
You know, you talked about, you peppered a term in there that I want to come back to. You talked about co-creating brands, and I think that that's something that we're, you know, hearing more and more of, whether that's co-creating internally with our team, but also with the customer as well.
Yeah.
How do you define that concept of co-creation?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think, again, just judging from my experience, unless you are starting from scratch, unless you're launching a brand, it's probably less a matter of co-creation and more a matter of unearthing. You know, if you unearth the truth about a brand, that's very suggestive that the people in the company have some view of that. Its customers have some view of that. Even its competitors have some view of that. And all of those various viewpoints, you know, the old analogy about the different views of the elephant, add up to what the brand is. And so maybe co-creating is a little arrogant, I don't know, of a term when, you know, one of the power branding principles that I have is that, you know, the more powerful you brand, the more powerful your brand is, the less of it you own, which is kind of a weird contradiction, you know, on the surface. But that's because the more powerful your brand is, the more invested your customers are in the brand, not to mention your employees. And so you can't just, you know, in the case of Netflix, when they came out with that new brand, I think they called it Quickster.
Uh-huh.
They put a handful of their customers, they said, "You're now a Quickster customer." And the customer said, "No, I'm not." You know, that's the idea. So co-creating might be a little bit of an arrogant approach because we're not really co-creating it. But co-unearthing does make sense. And so that suggests that you explore, you know, what you internally think about your own brand, what your employees think about your brand, what your customers think about your brand. And all of a sudden you're putting together a pretty good research and discovery protocol to unearth the truth. And that's, you know, I think that's generally speaking how we go about it, because you want to get, there's another principle that is, if you're in business and you're making a profit or you've been in business for any length of time, you're doing something right for somebody. So the key is to find that somebody and figure out what it is that you're doing right and do more of it. And that's actually most of the time when companies lose their way and they lose their focus, it's because it's for one of two reasons. They either got cocky and they thought they could do more than they're really called to do underneath their brand banner, or they started struggling because of the economy or a new competitor for some reason, and they started casting about and losing their focus and chasing business they shouldn't have chased. In both cases, really the solution is to refocus them back on their core identity. Identities do change over time, but they tend to change slowly, not on a dime.
Well, you talk about, you know, figuring out something that you're doing right and doing more of it. And I mean, I do think that for whatever reason, it seems like we have the kind of this almost like adult ADD brand edition, you know, where we kind of think that we are, that our brands, you know, should be in every business, should be extended, should be everything to everyone. And I mean, I think if you look at, you know, ones that are communicated, that are strong, that they are, that they almost are all grounded with some sort of focus.
Yeah. And what it may be is that if you're feeling that your brand identity is too constricted, it may not be that you cast about for, you know, add-ons. It may be that you elevate and your brand means something more. Like, for instance, and I'm just sort of speaking off the cuff here, but if you look at a Starbucks and who knows if they're making mistakes, you know, if they're over expanding the brand, but maybe Starbucks isn't, you know, really just about coffee. So that's why we give them permission to do tea, and maybe we give them permission to do snacks, and maybe we give them permission in some cases to do, you know, wine, which I think they're doing in some locations, because they famously talked about Starbucks being the third place, mm-hmm. you know, with home being the first place and work being the second place, and Starbucks wants to be the third place. And so maybe, you know, on the surface, you think Starbucks is about coffee, and so therefore they should do nothing but coffee, when in reality, it's not that they're extending the brand, it's that they're elevating the brand, and they're getting a bird's eye view of it, and it's really about more than coffee and maybe always was, they just didn't know it. But that's when you need, you know, the objective, helpful, caring outsider who'll tell you the truth. Because it really is easy within a brand to say, hey, you know, we can do anything. And we see that over and over.
So when you talked about the jerky autocrat wannabe, you talked kind of about the opinion. I love the idea of asking your wife, you know, what is the who is that outsider that brands can go to ask that tough question?
Yeah. You know, what's funny is there are many. I think any good brand consultant or advertising agency desperately wants to tell you the truth. The key is really is the person, is the CEO or the CMO or whoever's in charge, willing to ask.
Yeah.
Because if they're willing to ask, they're going to get the right answer. And you know what? The crazy thing is, if they're willing to ask, they may not need to ask because they've got a certain level of humility and they're willing to confront the truth. It's when they're in denial that, you know, you can tell them the truth and you'll get fired.
Yeah. Well, and so, I even think, even on the agency consultant side, I think sometimes even when there's another subset there of those that will ask, but they won't believe what you tell them because they know better.
We have experienced that quite often. You know, getting engaged with us is time consuming and expensive. So you have to be in a certain place as a company to know you need fixing. And there've been many occasions where we see the issue, but the time isn't right for the company because they're not at that point of, you know, whether they're in denial or whether they're in partial denial or whether they just haven't faced up to it. They're just not ready to admit that they need help. But when they get to that point, they just want somebody to tell them the truth. And if you do that kindly, which is one of our operating principles, is tell the kind truth always. Several times they've come back to us. You know, clients that we have not been successful with, prospects, a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, have come back. And they said, we're ready. Which is pretty gratifying too.
So it's, you talk about, just mentioned Starbucks, and it's like that's kind of one of our go-to big brands, great brands, great examples of a brand: Starbucks, Nike, Apple. I think other than Nike, we've touched on all of them already. And I think sometimes there's this hesitation. It's funny because people want to kind of adopt some of those things, the Steve Jobs stories, when it kind of suits them. But I think other times they're like, oh, no. We're a small business. We're a B2B company. We're this, we're that. There aren't lessons from these kind of flagship brands that we can learn. That's why I love the focus of power branding. Literally, as the subtitle says, you talk about leveraging the success of the world's best brands. So what can we learn in a way that is accessible for businesses, organizations of different shapes and sizes.
That is exactly why I wrote the book. And there are 75 power branding principles. That sounds awful, doesn't it?
I'm frightened. You know, it feels like it's not like a War and Peace size book, is it?
No, and that's the thing. I was a little bit nervous when I wrote it because these are very bite-sized chapters. They're about a page or two each, and I thought this is kind of unusual. I've gotten more compliments you wouldn't believe, because if you're like me, a lot of people, you know, I think are like this. When you're reading any kind of a book, when you start a chapter, you kind of want to finish it in that sitting. And it can be very intimidating if the chapter is 20, 30, 40 pages long. In the case of power branding, it takes you, 4 minutes per chapter. And so you can read 10 at a time or you can read one at a time. So there's 75 principles, 75 very short chapters that has worked out really, really well, which, you know, in retrospect, in this age of no attention span, social media, Twitter, and so forth, is perfect. But the reason I wrote the book was I've been preaching for so long that the big brands aren't successful because they're big. They're big because they're successful, if that makes sense. They stumbled. I mean, Nike, stumbled. I want to give them credit where credit is due. But they stumbled upon the magic formula when they were a very small company. You know, they're Nike now.
Yeah.
And likewise with Starbucks and likewise with Apple. I mean, Apple's sort of maybe the rare exception because Steve Jobs was such a force of nature, you know, that won't be repeated. But when he took the company back over, they were bankrupt. You know, they were nowhere. It's because there are principles that these brands followed, and they had some breaks go their way, that they became the iconic brands that they are. And any company can embrace power branding principles and get miles ahead of its competition. And again, the book, you know, you can read it straight through, or in the back there's an index of power branding principles, and they're sort of nice turns of phrases. And if any of them pique somebody's interest, they can read one at a time. And I've even organized it by, you know, target audience versus brand strategy versus execution and so forth. So it's very accessible, and that's really close to my heart.
Well, that's very cool. It's right up my alley in terms of what I write, speak, and teach about, and I love that approach too. We're of the same mind. I was thinking when you were talking about, you know, that there are 75 of them, but they're these bite sized. I thought, well, that seems like it would fit today, because I think that sometimes books, especially business books, seem like they can kind of get bloated up to what the size of all of them are supposed to be, the size, the shape, the, you know, the chapters, the sub, all of these things. And sometimes it just kind of all smushes together.
Yeah, it does. It does. There's sort of a formula that business books take, and this one's different.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. So in talking about the good feedback you've received, and because there are 75 and I can't supersize my podcast as we're in the back nine of the recording here. This is the point where I say, so walk us through all 75.
Walk us through all.
Yeah. So just kick back, take your shoes off and start through. But what are the ones that you hear the most about as you talk about the book, as you get feedback from readers?
You know, it's really funny because I've got sort of a Twitter freak going on right now.
as in your own use, or you there is a freak that is after you on Twitter.
There's somebody who's been quoting from the book quite extensively, which I always find fascinating. And you know what? Can I just say this? Total pet peeve. In two of the principles that they've quoted, they've had typos, and I don't know what to do because I want to tell them, could you fix that? But I'm like, no, I appreciate you tweeting it.
Yeah, that's tough because I'm the same way. I'm a bit obsessive about typos and things like that. And I wouldn't want to tamp that down though.
No. So a couple that have just been tweeted recently, that today they tweeted, there's nothing you do that isn't sending a message one way or another, which is a power branding principle that, you know, tries to get companies to recognize that it's not about your advertising. I mean, that's certainly included, but there isn't anything you do. Your hiring practices, your onboarding practices, your HR manual, your operating guidelines, all of that are branding. And, you know, the best companies understand that. Another one they quoted was, you know, doesn't it make sense to challenge your own conventions before somebody else does? And the idea behind that principle is that every industry develops conventions. And very often the first competitor to challenge those conventions and jump out of it can make some real progress. And the example in the book of that is, you know, 15 years ago, humor in the insurance industry was anathema. You would never do that until Geico did it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Aflac's doing it, State Farm's doing it, Allstate's doing it, Progressive is doing it. You can't find an advertiser that isn't using humor. But Geico got the jump on them. So the new convention in the insurance industry is humor. So somebody has to figure out something else, which leads to, you know, a third power branding principle that this Twitter person quoted, which is the way it has always been done is not the way it must always be done. Meaning, you know, always be challenging your own conventions in the context of your brand identity. You don't want to violate your brand, but there are certain inviolables and there are certain things that you can violate. Well, those are just three examples from the last 2 days.
Those are great. And, you know, I like that you know, we're talking about, because I think that's a tricky part of identity also, because I think some people, it's hard to unpack, but to some, branding is consistency. And while it is, there's a frustrating yes and no to that, because like you said, you have to figure out which things are the absolutes and which pieces are ones that you can bend and play with a bit.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps a good analogy for that is, you know, if you were to ask the average person on the street when Pepsi changed their logo, they wouldn't be able to tell you. But if you were to pull Pepsi's logos from the last 50 or 80 years, they continually change. I mean, they change it actually pretty frequently, but they do it in such a way that it's more subtle.
Well, and it's variations on a theme too.
Yeah.
So that's why
it
maintains
its integrity, right?
Yeah, you know, it's like the joke about, oh, careful, the brand police are going to come get us. And as opposed to the consistency, that it's really kind of part of a bigger coherence from the brand experiences that we're building today.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that frustrates me is we tend to get into this thing where we get vested in words, taglines, what have you, and that's destructive in two ways. One way it's destructive is that it people put too much stock in taglines. Don't get me started on that. But the second way it's destructive is people think that you can't vary or deviate from certain words with respect to a brand, which is just kind of silly. And the reason is because brands represent ideas, and ideas are imperfectly expressed with words. Ideas can be expressed with words. They can also be expressed with images. You know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. They can be expressed through video. Ideas are very complex things, but sometimes we have to reduce them to words, and words operate in a part of the brain that is not complete. So I don't want to get too weird on you now, but when companies start being, you know, too strict about their language guidelines or their tagline or even their logo guidelines, it's too much. It's just clamping down too much, and it's not allowing for the natural nip and tuck that a brand has to go through. You know, it's like a tree. It's going to keep growing, and you have to allow it to grow. If you try to restrict it too much, you'll kill it.
That's a really, really good analogy too, the tree, and that it's going to. Because I think too that we have that restrictive language in every bad corporate style guide out there, as opposed to guidelines about tone and voice that are absent. And yet it's, you know, because you talk about you're too restrictive with words, and you look at the prevalence of words in modern brand building and words that everyone, you know, that it's not just stuff that you're outsourcing to the agency, that it is, you know, what the words that, you know, are in the aforementioned onboarding and HR documents and, you know, who's tweeting for your brand and who's putting together your 30-second spot like Geico. So all of these disparate pieces that are word-based, and I think sometime we go too far the other direction into restrictive mode.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, the danger is, there's dangers in around every corner, because the reason we lock it down is because if we don't lock it down, it can get out of hand. And that may be a bigger challenge. You know, it may be a bigger threat, especially if you're a big brand or a distributed brand, or you've got franchisees or licensees or something where, you know, they'll do all kinds of stuff with your logo and your language. So you try to lock it down. So there's got to be, I mean, it's going to be different for every brand and every company. The one thing that's consistent, I think, is you need a very powerful center of gravity owning the expression of the brand. I was going to say owning the brand, but everybody owns the brand. And so that, whether that's the CEO, which it should be in every case, or the CMO, or in some cases the agency, we've been in that position sometimes, they have to have this strong gravitational pull. And when I mean that sincerely, the gravitational pull is much more effective than trying to build a fence.
Yeah.
And you know, you get a gravitational pull by having credibility and likability and trust. You can build a fence, you know, even if everybody hates you and tries to is always trying to bust out of it. So that's critical.
And does that pull need to be anchored by something? You know, is it a concept? Is it a construct, an understanding?
Yes. It's job security for you and me, because so few people genuinely understand all this stuff. Yeah. And that's not, you know, an arrogant statement. It's just that we who live our lives doing this, you know, the more we learn, the more we realize we don't know. And the more, you know, I'm sure you're like me, where you can't walk down the street or turn on the television without thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, why did they do what they're doing? And is it smart or is it dumb? And why am I having the reaction I'm having to it? And all that sort of thing. That's our job. It's what we do.
Yeah.
We divine principles out of that. Most people don't think about it.
Well, and you know, again, and I think that's where you know, these big brands can be, these the brands you talk about in the book can be kind of touchstones for everyone out there. Because, I mean, as you're saying this, as you're talking about that gravitational pull, I think about a brand like Zappos, that everything, that construct, the concept at the center of that is service, as opposed to restrictions of what's right and what's wrong. It seems like everything, you can see it pull, that you can see that pull across all aspects of the business.
And that pull, that gravitational force, was the CEO.
Yeah. And it did come from there. Yeah.
Is the CEO, although now that they're part of Amazon, all bets are off.
Yeah.
Long term.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, as we start to wrap up, and speaking of Amazon, here's my attempt at a clumsy segue with the hidden smile in the Amazon logo. What is a brand that has made you smile recently, Steve McKee?
It's funny that you ask that question that way, because
was it Amazon?
No. But you're forcing me to be honest, where I probably wouldn't give you this answer. But I literally chuckled over the weekend at a brand multiple times, partly because my wife was scrunching her face and scratching her head, and that is Old Spice. And I have to say, here's, you know, the target is my teenage son, right? It's not me.
Mm-hmm.
But I chuckle because it's so well targeted to him. And so my wife just says, I don't get it. And I'm like, I know you don't, and you're not supposed to. And I only get it because I was a teenage boy. Right? but it made me smile because it's so, two levels. One, it's just so stupid, smart, stupid. You know what I'm saying? I'm giving it credit. It's just so wacky. But I also smile because here's a brand that was around when I was a kid and got so stalled, so stuck, and so stale that it might as well have gone out of business. You know, the old sailor and the whistle. And this is Old Spice we're talking about. This is Oldsmobile, you know? And yet they have completely revitalized the brand and done a magnificent job with that. So from a professional standpoint, I smile because I just say, job well done.
Well, it's funny because we were with family over the holidays, and I think, like you said, I used to be a teenage boy, and so did my father, who I was with, and that was on TV, and it produced a very similar response. Laughed out loud at kind of at the most recent spot, but it's worth noting. I teach at the University of Iowa here, and I have to explain and kind of give a history lesson, and I feel like it only makes me sound older to students trying to explain Old Spice was not always as cool as you know it now. I had to explain that it was that bottle that your grandpa had on the shelf in his bathroom.
Yeah, and you know, I have to give him another prop because there was a Twitter exchange with another brand that's targeted to those boys, which is Taco Bell.
Yes.
And Old Spice tweeted to Taco Bell, it's kind of deceptive to have fire sauce because does your sauce really have fire in it? And then Taco Bell tweeted back something like, yeah, and do you make your product with really old spices? And I just thought they were having that banter back and forth. And of course, they've both done such a great job with social, again, because of their audience. They're just being really smart.
Well, and again, it's a great example. You get back to words and where some are restrictive with them. They have both established voice in a way that so many haven't, and in a way that leaves itself open to that kind of vamping and improvisation that is incomprehensible to many.
And maybe they have an advantage because when you're targeting teenage boys, you can make mistakes. I don't know.
Yeah, true.
But good for them.
Steve, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Our website is mckeewallwork.com. That's McKee, M-C-K-E-E, and Wallwork, which is wall and work. .com or powerbrandingbook.com if they'd like to learn more about the book. Of course, it's available everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so forth. But I'd love to hear some people. I'm at Steve McKee on Twitter, and love that as well.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Steve, thanks for being on Brand with us.
Pleasure, Nick. Thank you.
And speaking of the community and co-creating and all of that, we always like to close by flipping the microphone around to our listeners. Big shout out to Angie Greiner, who was excited for our recent episode featuring Aaron Draplin. Thanks for tweeting, Angie. Hope you enjoyed the episode. And a reminder, if you liked something, or if you heard something that you liked on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let us know on Twitter using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Last but not least, as noted, you can find links to everything that we talked about over at branddrivendigital.com. You can also subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, it's that final reminder that we make every week to head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.